The benthic community that we were interested in is composed of coprophagous beetles, coprophagous flies, predatory beetles, predatory flies, and parasitoid wasps. Studies that have been done to assess the question, what are the effects of veterinary pesticide residues on non-target dung-dwelling insect species, have come up with mixed results. We have some studies that have shown that veterinary pesticide residues negatively impact dung-dwelling insect species, and other studies have shown that there are no such negative impacts on these insects. Some of the factors that lead to these disparate results are climatic conditions of the region, scale of application of veterinary parasiticides, as well as the number of animals that are treated. Our hypothesis for our experiment was that dung-containing veterinary parasiticide residues will negatively impact the numbers of emergence of adult insects. We expect to see lower rates of emergence in controlled dung in comparison to ivermectin dung and doramectin dung. We also expected to see a greater reduction in the number of emerging insects close to the time of treatment with veterinary parasiticides. We also expected to see no difference in herd. I will explain my experiment in greater detail in the following slides, and I'm going to start with this slide, which explains the factors that we use in our experiment. We included veterinary parasiticides, which we had 3 levels, time, which we had 8 levels, and herd, of which we had 2 levels. This yielded a 3x8x2 factorial design. We replicated by individual cow, and our response variable was the numbers of emerging dung-dwelling fauna. Here we show 2 separate herds that were treated with formulations of 2 commonly used veterinary parasiticides. Each herd was divided into a control treatment group, a doramectin treatment group, and an ivermectin treatment group. While the control group received no treatment of veterinary parasiticides, the doramectin and ivermectin groups both received a topical application at the label rate of 500 micrograms per kilogram body weight. For each treatment group, there were 6 cattle. And here are the colors, gray for control, blue for doramectin, and green for ivermectin, will remain consistent throughout the remainder of the presentation. Dung was collected from each individual cow every week for a total of 8 weeks post-treatment with veterinary parasiticides. The dung from each individual cow was kept separate and had at minus 20 degrees Celsius until it was to be placed in the field. Prior to being placed in the field, the dung was allowed to defrost for a period of 24 hours. Placing our dung packs out in the field, we followed the protocol outlined in Float 1998, which consisted of a styrofoam plate, which was 21 centimeters in diameter. The plate was covered with a 2-centimeter bed of sand, and each plate had a 0.5-liter defrosted dung pack placed on it. The plates were placed in a randomized grid design in a pasture without grazing cattle, which was adjacent to a pasture where there actually were cattle grazing. The plates were remained in the field for a period of 48 hours, upon which time the pat and the plate was picked up, placed in an 11-liter white plastic bucket, which was fitted with a fine mesh sleeve, which prevented emerging insects from escaping. These buckets were monitored weekly, and upon emergence, adult insects were aspirated, stored in 70% alcohol, and later identified the order. When we got our data, we square root transformed our data and ran a repeated measures ANOVA using a proc mix function in SAS. Here's our data. This figure represents the effect of veterinary parasiticide residues on insect emergence by order. On our x-axis, we have the orders of insects that emerge from our dung packs. On the y-axis, we have mean insect emergence. Gray bars represent control, blue bars are for doramectin, and green bars are for ivermectin. As we can see here, veterinary parasiticides had no negative impacts on diptera emergence. However, in Hymenoptera, we see a significant effect of emergence, but it's reverse of what we have hypothesized. We can see that there are higher rates of insect emergence for the Hymenoptera in doramectin and control treatments than doramectin and ivermectin treatments, in comparison to control treatments. And we can see in Coleoptera there were no negative impacts of veterinary parasiticides. This figure shows the effect of veterinary parasiticides on diptera emergence by week. On the x-axis, we have weeks post-treatment, ranging from weeks 1 through 8, and on the y-axis, we have mean insect emergence. What we can see here is the gray boxes represent control, the blue diamonds represent doramectin, and the green triangles represent ivermectin. We expect to see higher rates of insect emergence in controls, and we did not observe this. We also expected to see a reduction in insect emergence in weeks 1 through 3, which were closer to treatment time with veterinary parasiticides, and we did not see this either. This figure represents, again, veterinary parasiticides, but on hymenopter emergence, with the axis remaining the same, as the x-axis being weeks post-treatment, 1 through 8, y-axis is immune insect emergence. We can see that, again, control did not yield a higher mean insect emergence, and also there was not a reduction in earlier weeks, 1 through 3, with treatment of veterinary parasiticides. This figure represents the veterinary parasiticide effect on Coleoptera. Again, we expected control to be higher, which we did not see, and then we did not see a reduction in earlier weeks, even though this was only over 3 weeks, the rest of the data is still to be analyzed. So to summarize our results, we saw a treatment effect, but it was a reverse treatment effect and was present in the Hymenoptera. We saw no effect of time and no effect of herd. So some reasons why we might have seen this reverse effect in Hymenoptera. Literature reports that diphtheria larvae that are subjected to moderate levels of veterinary parasiticide residues in the dung do not experience the deleterious effects that they would if there were higher concentrations of veterinary parasiticides in the dung. And also, diphtheria larvae that are present in the dung that are subjected to veterinary parasiticide residues are not able to encapsulate the parasitoid eggs. Both of these mean that you could have a higher yield or higher emergence of parasitoids, which was conclusive to what we saw. So our conclusion was that we have no reason to believe that veterinary parasiticides lead to negative effects for dung-dwelling insect species in the Columbia Basin in central Washington. And with that, I'd like to thank Dr. Dave Horton, Chris White, and the research technicians for aiding me in my research, and the WSU Department of Entomology for funding. And with that, I'll take any questions.
When you put those dung caps in place, they were just there for 48 hours?
Correct.
So you just look at the insects and let's say they're in that period of time, right?
Correct. We're looking at the insects. We're usually left them out for 48 hours because of environmental conditions in Prosser. It's really dry, really hot. So we were trying to reduce the amount of desiccation that would happen on these plates. So we left them out for 48 hours, which allowed insects to come and colonize, overposit, and then they left.
All you're finding is that the first closing, maybe that time, the other one come later on, and
the insects break down. No, we were looking at just in that 48-hour time frame because we had run an earlier trial and left it out there for successive days, and what happened was because of the environmental conditions, like I said, being on that plate lifted off the soil, not much rain falling, we had high rates of desiccation and just mortality across the board, everything was killed because of the environmental conditions. We ran this experiment in late July out in Prosser, and in the field in Prosser, Washington, it's pretty warm then. Right. Face flies and horse flies, there was a really large range. Some packs we would see 10 to 20, and then some packs we'd have 80, 90 of face fly. We didn't get much horn fly at all, if any, overpositing on the path, so insect emergence was pretty low. And again, I think this is attributed to the time of year we ran this experiment. It would be beneficial to run this experiment, I think, early in the spring when conditions are more favorable to overposition and having, you know, larger numbers of overposition out in the field when it's cooler and not as dry.
How much sand?
I use 2 centimeters to evenly cover the plate. So it's about, you know, just enough sand that would allow developing insects to leave the pad and then go pupating the sand to finish their development.
Aren't they specific just for parasites, and do they also kill insects?
Well, the parasiticides, that's like really what's going on with the literature. There's parasiticides that are aimed at controlling nematodes and such, and they also target some diphtheria. But the parasiticides are reported to have negative effects on non-target insects. So we're talking about dung beetles, and that's a great concern because of their benefit into, you know, maintaining pasture health.
Well, if it kills flies,
that would be a positive side effect, but if it's killing beetles as well, then these beetles are not being able to recycle these dung packs and all the nutrients back into the pasture, and then also, when the dung pack sits there and it's not decomposed, then it's killing the potential feed or forage that's around for the cattle. So, you kind of have, you know, double-edged sword there.
Well,
understand that we would have a three of mine, we have a number of thousands,
That's a great question. I feel that I think environmental factors of where the study took place could be a reason. I also think that possible resistance to maybe veterinary parasiticides. These cattle producers have been applying these parasiticides for a while, so there could be a component of resistance buildup within the species. No studies have been done within the Pacific Northwest, let alone the inland Pacific Northwest, addressing these impacts, so we don't really have any baseline data out there as to why exactly or what would we expect with these veterinary parasiticides. Thank you.
Here, mountain streams that have high levels of metals. We're working with very low levels of metals in this study, and so you're not going to just wipe out the populations. So, methods for this study. We sampled in the summer of 2007. We used 17 streams, and for the metal part of it, I took three samples from each stream. I took sediment samples from the top 2 centimeters, so just the bioavailable part of it, and water samples. I used nitric acid digestion and atomic absorption spectroscopy, many countless hours injecting into that machine. And for the benthic community samples, we used a standard kick net, and we tossed back any vertebrates we got, but we brought everything else back to the lab and preserved it and identified everything down to genus. We also took your typical pH, water, water temperature, pH, conductivity, and hardness for each of the streams. Now these coastal Alabama streams are very slow moving. Our substrate is basically sand. We have a little bit of silt, a little bit of mud, a little bit of clay, but you typically just have a sandy bottom stream. The habitat that we sampled the most were in snags, depicted right up here. But we did have streams that looked similar to this, that there were very few snags, there was very little vegetation or roots, so they were pretty clear. There's not a high organic matter in the sediments. So just for our water quality measurements, the important things to note is that we had a pH of about 6. With a lower pH, you're going to have more metals suspended in the water, so it's going to be more bioavailable to the organisms. So we had a pH of 6, so that was all right. But our hardness was only 8. These are very, very soft streams. And so with a hardness of 8, it's going to lower your toxicity values. So a lower value of metals in the water can be harmful and detrimental to the organisms. So what did we end up with? Well, my metals in the sediment were all very, very low. You would kind of predict this with sandy bottom streams, not a high organic matter in there. So none of these are going to be of concern. Metals in the water was a slightly different story with that, with the soft water. So we have still low levels, but all of the lead levels were could be of concern. They could be of harming the aquatic life if long-term exposure. So they were all above limits set by the EPA, and this is calculated down for hardness. So our cadmium levels, 10 of the streams were above acceptable levels. And copper, most of my streams were below detection limit, and I only had 4 streams that I could measure, and they don't pose any threat. So copper was not a problem. So for the actual benthic community, we are focusing on 4 orders, so the odonates, the plecopteras, coleopteras, and trichopteras, and we have a total of 49 genera. So we wanted to make sure that we got a good representation of the genera that were there, and for we did 17 different sites, and we're confident that we have a good sampling effort there. So out of these 49 genera that we found, we're just going to concentrate on the top 11. So we're going to go ahead and eliminate the lower ranking ones. And here's our top 11. So we're just going to use 4 of the odonates, 3 of the plecopteras, 2 of the coleopteras, and 2 of the trichopteras. We ran regression analysis trying to see if we could pull out any of the metals as a predictor to what's going on in the streams. So just using richness, we could pull out that the copper in the sediment could be used to predict the richness with an R-squared of 33.8. And then we looked at individual genera abundances and to see if we could pull out any metals that could help predict those. And we had anything from a ranging of R-squared of 25 to the 67 that you see. So we actually can use some of our metals in the water and in the sediment to predict our species abundances. So when we have 17 streams, we ran a ward cluster analysis on just the metal data, just to see if we could break these up into a couple groups. And the cluster came out nicely into two groups. If we looked at, to see if there's any differences in the metals in these two groups, the lead in the water actually was the only thing that had a significant difference. Group one had higher lead levels than group two, and the sediment, there was no differences. So we have our two groups, and the 11 genera that we focused on. We ran a discriminant function analysis of the heavy metals versus the community. And they actually, our community broke up nicely in, with these two groups. We could predict the community of it. And the four that contributed to the most are listed here. So, back to the original questions I asked. Are there areas of concern due to the metal concentrations? And just using the copper, cadmium, and lead. And the metals in the sediment, there was no concern. They can, even though there's no concern, they can still be used as a predictor. And the metals in the water may have some effects on the aquatic life. We'll be able to hopefully see some variation in the seasonal sampling. But, and then the second question was, can aquatic insect community be predicted based upon metal concentrations? And we were able to see, even though the metals in the sediment weren't of concern to hurt the aquatic life, we can still use them as predictors. They were pulled out to predict abundances, and when we grouped the two streams, they could still be used to predict the insect community. So even these low levels could still help. And I'd like to acknowledge everybody that helped and the funding.
We have time for a couple of questions.
I'm not a toxicologist. How does the hardness of the water influence?
The hardness goes with the pH, and your metals will bind to organic matter or particles in the water, and they usually settle out. If you lower your pH and you have softer water, the metals will break those binding properties and become an ionic form, and so they're in the water, suspended in the water. And then in the metal ions can be taken in by the organisms easier, and that's when they really cause problems.
Any more questions? So thank you.
Thank you.
In the United States, as well as in Europe, subterranean termites in the genus Rutictermes are the most expensive and damaging pest species.
This is some work I did as an undergrad at Georgia Southern University in the lab of Dr. Dana Nadich. What I did is I studied houseflies, which thrive in very septic environments. And because of that, they tend to harbor bacteria and other pathogens. Previous studies has cultured Aeromonas species from houseflies. And despite living in these septic environments, flies are very resistant to bacterial infection. And this resistance can be caused by physiological factors or physical barriers. I decided to look at physical barriers by examining the fate of bacteria in the housefly digestive tract. Here's a sketch of housefly anatomy. When flies eat, they vomit material from the crop and then suck it in liquefied food. They store it in the crop, and then from the crop, they send it into the proventriculus and into the gut system. As many of you may know, insects have a paratrophic matrix, House flies have a type 2 paratrophic matrix, which is double layered, as you can see here. The inner layer surrounds the food bolus.